Relax, you got nothing to lose. What do you think? I'm about to show you. The female of the species is more deadly than a male.
Deadly.
Show me a movie, you can say it again. Just wait till you see what I did at the end. The female of the species is more deadly than a male.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to More Deadly, the Director's Cut, where we speak with the women-identified directors who are making the movies we love oh so much. More Deadly is a trans-inclusive podcast where we celebrate the work of cis and trans women, as well as non-binary filmmakers who are comfortable being included in a space that centers the work of women. Joining me is the very best podcast co-host a girl could ever hope for. It's the one and only Ariel. Hey,
hello.
Girl!
Hi.
How are you?
I'm doing good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, you can be in charge of that today because I'm freaking tired.
Well, I did not say I was awake or not tired, but I'm doing good.
You know, I'm exhausted. I'm getting ready to go to Horror Hound, so I have some packing to do tonight. It's going to be a long night. But if there is one thing that I will get up for and get excited about every single time, it is talking to women horror directors.
Yes.
So, of course, I'm ready to go. I'm super excited. And this one, I think, is going to be really, really interesting. We're going to be covering a new film that's dropping on Shudder. Like, I don't know, maybe today when you're listening to this, today or yesterday or the day, you know, somewhere around here this week. It's a new film called You'll Never Find Me. And so in support of that, I, in this case, got to sit down with the actually directing duo of Indiana Bell and Josiah Allen, two really rad Australian filmmakers, to talk about the making of a pretty unique film.
Mm-hmm.
So before we move forward on this, though, Ariel, how do we handle spoilers on this show?
So on More Deadly Director's Cut, we do things a little bit differently. We're going to try our best to avoid spoilers, but we do touch on some things about the film in the interview that, I don't know, could possibly be considered a spoiler. So just proceed with caution, but we're really going to stay pretty general, I think.
Yeah, this one's not super spoilery. I think you'll be okay. First things first, I'm going to tell you a little bit about our directors and the making of the film. Then you and I are going to give a quick, super quick, non-spoilery, high-level review of the film, let you know if we think you should check it out, and then we'll get into the interview. Sound good?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Awesome. Okay, so today we are going to be talking about, as I said, Australian writer and director Indiana Bell, who, along with her writing and directing partner Josiah Allen, created their first feature film, You'll Never Find Me. They are both hailing from the southern city of Adelaide. Bell and Allen actually attended university together, and that's where they sort of joined forces and what came to be like a series of short films. They've actually been very prolific working together. So they graduated in 2016. Bell earned her Bachelor of Creative Arts in Screen Production. After that, she and Josiah and the third member of their cinematic cabal, John Chataway, joined together to form Stakeout Films. Under this banner, they shot numerous short films and even some commercials, but Indiana focused on screenwriting while Josiah handled storyboards. So, like, they really are very much a creative, like, pairing. Like, they have kind of figured out sort of this great way to work together and really bounce off each other creatively, as you will hear in the interview itself. Like,
that's
they
really
have
cool.
A really great dynamic. Yeah. So Bell scored at the World Series of Screenwriting in 2018, taking home the gold prize for comedy for her feature screenplay Microwave Me.
Ooh.
Another one, Safe Space, also won Best Directing and the Young Filmmaker Award at the South Australian Screen Awards. So she's been kicking butt
pretty much
from day one. Yeah, super cool. Next up, she after Safe Space came a short called Call Connect, in which Bell wrote, she wrote solo, but brought it to the screen along with Allen. This one focused on a young woman's first day as a helpline operator. But it is more of a drama, which is something we'll actually get into. these two filmmakers are new, not just to making horror, but liking horror.
Yeah, that's so crazy.
Right? We actually have a really great conversation about it, so I won't go too much into it in this introduction. But just know that they are on quite a journey playing catch up with all the amazing horror films out there. So Belle won the jury first prize for best narrative short at the 2019 Austin Film Festival. The next year at AFF, Belle was named one of the top 25 screenwriters to watch.
Wow. That's incredible.
I mean, I'm not done. After this, she wrote and teamed up again with Alan to co-direct a thriller short called The Recordist. Again, this led to an award for the duo, specifically the jury prize for best narrative short film at the Austin Film Festival.
Oh, wow.
Yes. And this was a big deal because by winning that prize, the short became eligible for for Academy Award consideration.
What? Oh, I didn't realize that.
Mm-hmm. They're kind of a big deal.
Yeah.
So while it wasn't selected, it was still an amazing honor and just continue to like push their careers and level up their, you know, profile in the filmmaking industry. Which honestly, we're going to talk about that a little bit in the interview and you can kind of understand why Indiana gives the answer she does. So all the while, Belle was campaigning for autism awareness and working as a disability caregiver. So she also has a freaking heart of gold. Wow. She's gorgeous. She's an amazing writer. She's an amazing filmmaker and she's a good person. My God, leave some of it for the rest of us, Indiana. Juice. But yeah, so she actually took this experience and added it into her creative repertoire. She turned this experience into her first children's book, Quirky Quentin.
Oh, wow.
Yep. Yeah. So Indiana's kind of amazing. And honestly, Alan, like her partner's, he's super great. I actually found their dynamic, like I said, really inspiring, as you will see in the interview. All right. So let me tell you about the film. As it so happens, Alan says that the concept for this film actually kind of came down to what was available for them resource-wise and with their tight, tight budget.
That actually makes sense with this kind of a film.
Right, because this is a very, very contained.
Yeah, it's basically two people in a single location. Room.
Yeah. Yeah, so it was like a necessity to fit the film into one location because of the budget constraints.
Mm-hmm.
Alan was so impressed by the performances of Brendan Rock and Jordan Cowan, who starred in their short, The Recordist, that he wanted to cast them in a full-length film, like in a cramped location. That way they could like really focus in on sort of the power dynamics between the two of them. So yeah, they've actually starred together. And when they wrote these parts, they wrote them with these two people specifically in mind. And I think it shows.
Oh yeah, for sure.
So the inspiration for the setting of the film in a trailer park came from the fact that they're so plentiful in Australia, apparently, and they're often very much off the beaten path. So it just kind of was like a perfect combination of things to make it a great location for a horror film. And they ended up finding one right there in their hometown of Adelaide. So that's easy.
Yeah.
They knew right from the start, it was important to them. They really wanted to create a film that was rewatchable, that had like lots of layers and lots of hints and clues and, you know, different things that you really pick up the second time around that are completely recontextualized because of you know where it's going.
Mm-hmm.
They wanted something that you would watch on repeat. And while the film itself actually has a lot of similar DNA to their short, The Recordist, this film was never intended to be like a remake of it. They just wanted to really showcase the performance of Brendan and Jordan. They were so blown away with them the first time they worked with them that they just like wanted to completely just like really dive into their chemistry.
Mission accomplished. Yeah.
No kidding. And man, this movie lives or dies on whether or not chemistry. So while writing the film, Belle actually took some inspiration, like all of us girlies do, from her love of true crime tales. Specifically those ones involving criminals who have like consciences. Again, this is something we touch a little bit on in the interview. And how someone like that kind of can get to the point where they commit horrible acts. While the film takes place during a storm, surprise, surprise, it's not a real one. It took a lot of clever hacks on the filmmaker's part, like they rigged hoses above windows and used them only when like the window was in frame to convey sort of the ongoing weather without expending a fortune on effects. So they were really creative in how they like managed to create that atmosphere with, again, very little budget. And then the rest of it was all audio magic by the film's sound designer, Duncan Campbell, which, again, something we definitely talk about in this interview, because I feel like there is a third character in this, and it is the sound.
Mm-hmm.
So the film premiered at Tribeca in 2023, but even before it managed to hit screens, it had already been acquired by Shudder, which is where...
That's so cool.
Yeah, I know, right? I mean, they just like can't stop kicking ass, and which is where it has dropped this week. So if you have Shudder, you can absolutely go ahead and get your eyeballs on this thing right now. And you know what? It's pretty good. But we'll get into that in our review. So that's what I got. That's what I got for them right now. Would you give us a quick synopsis, Ariel?
Sure. Okay. So there is this older man who is living at the back of like a desolate caravan park, like Rachel was talking about. And there is a terrible storm going on when a young woman knocks on his door looking for shelter. And the rest of the movie is basically the two of them inside the small home trying to suss out who has nefarious intent, really. As like they start not trusting each other, and there's like fear and paranoia, and it just sort of ratchets up over the course of this one night. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's basically it.
Yeah, no, I mean, without getting into spoilers, I think you really nailed it. Awesome. Okay, so Errol, what did you think of this movie?
I really, really liked this movie.
I knew you would. This thing was like made for you.
Yeah, it really was, because one, there is, of course, this central mystery of who is the bad guy here. And I always find that so fascinating when you're watching something and you can't tell, because there are moments when you think one person is not a good person and is like about to do something really bad, and then it switches and you think it's the other person, and then it switches back, and it kind of does that over and over again over the course of this night until you get to a point where you realize what actually is going on. And I always think that is so interesting, and watching the kind of like you, as you learn about the characters and a little tiny bits about their backstory, and they're kind of finding out little bits of information about each other that are making, you know, one of them suspicious or the other one suspicious. I just thought that was fascinating. And the acting is so good that there was like tension throughout the whole thing. And that's another thing I love. If you give me like a slow burn that just like builds the tension and builds and builds and builds until a climax, I'm totally on board. And the way this movie ends is great.
Oh, I'm so glad. I actually really liked it too. I think it's a fascinating movie on a couple of levels. I mean, just from an entertainment value, I'll get into that. But I do think also there's something about kind of like it's audacious to try to create a feature film that is two people essentially in a room, one room together. Yeah. No, like with very, very little outside to get you through that time, and watching the craft that goes in to keeping it engaging, keeping the pace, keeping you on your toes so that it doesn't become repetitive, turning the screws in ways that don't always, like, you don't even realize how you're being manipulated in those moments. Like the craft of it, I think, is deeply, deeply fascinating. And then in terms of just entertainment value, there's something, I know this is like an overused descriptor, but there is something Hitchcockian about it, right? Mm-hmm. Like it is just in that you can feel that there's a bomb under the table and you never know when it's gonna go off, and who's got the detonator, you know? And so there is that kind of dread that he was a master of creating that is definitely homaged in this. I agree with you. The performances are really great. The characters are really compelling. I think it does a very good job of playing with that tension of like knowing, like recognizing your fear and dismissing it and being in a situation where politeness puts you in deeper and deeper and deeper trouble.
Yeah.
That is infuriating because it is so realistic.
Oh yeah, like the need to be polite or the desire to not hurt somebody's feelings or to make something uncomfortable, you know, like you just want to make everything nice. So right. you do what you shouldn't and don't listen to your instincts.
And then there's also the other side of that, which is mm-hmm. something so often, like, I think that it's easy to be like, these dummies, you just don't be polite. You be rude. Yeah. But it's actually not that simple, because oftentimes smiles, being polite, those are also survival tactics. You know, playing nice is one of the ways that we keep safe so that you don't anger someone. You know what I mean? And so I think this is good in showing sort of the complicated nature of that. Even when there are these massive red flags, when it's scariest is when she pushes back, actually, as opposed to when she's playing nice. And I think that's, it's really well done in that regard. But yeah, I enjoyed this quite a bit. I feel like it could easily have been one of those things that had a really cool buildup and then left you utterly unsatisfied by the end because they didn't actually know how to wrap it up, which, let's face it, we've seen a lot of those movies. Ooh, this one, I think, actually did a really good job of kind of having an idea of where it was going and not tipping its hand. Well, it tips its hand a lot, but it just keeps tipping it back and forth. So yeah, I also really enjoyed this. It's on Shudder today. I would absolutely recommend you check it out. What about you?
Yeah, me too, for sure. If you can make me tense and on the edge of my seat while somebody is making, like, heating up a can of tomato soup, then I'm in. Sold.
Right. Right. Oh, there's so many great moments. There's also a card game in this that that whole sequence to me is just perfection.
Yep.
All right. Awesome. Well, enough fangirling over the movie. Let's talk to the filmmakers who made the film. Let's get into our interview with Indiana Bell and Josiah Allen. So first of all, I'm just so excited to chat with you about this film today. It got great buzz coming out of the festivals, and now it's heading to Shudder. I'm curious, for each of you guys, as first-time filmmakers, what does it feel like to know that it's about to be seen by such a huge audience?
It's terrifying.
Yeah, it's terrifying. Yeah. It's very, very nerve-wracking, but that's what you make it for. The dream is for it to reach a wide audience of people who kind of love to consume this kind of film. So we couldn't be happier with working with Shudder. We're so excited to be releasing with them. Couldn't be happier.
Yeah, super excited. Yeah. And I think it was really nerve-wracking, before its first festival premiere at Tribeca, because it's one of those things where you're kind of like sitting in the dark editing together for, months and months on end, and you kind of start to lose perspective and go, does this even work? Are people going to like this? And so it was really nerve-wracking before the first screening, because literally no one had seen it apart from, a few crew people and people working on the film itself. So, that was a really cool experience, because it was kind of like, it was a feeling of relief, because so many people had given us so much time and we called in so many favors on this film and the crew had worked really hard. So it was kind of like, phew, okay, it's going to get seen, and people seem to be really enjoying it. And again, we just had that feeling of like gratitude and relief when we heard about Shudder, because we went, okay, it's found its home. It's going to be seen by the right eyeballs, and all the hard work that all these lovely crew people that we had on the shoot and in post-production will be seen. So that's really cool.
Yeah.
I love that. I just actually came back from South by Southwest yesterday afternoon and I sat in a few world premieres, and a couple of times I was seated like pretty close to the filmmakers, and I was thinking, I'm curious for you, what is that experience like to get to be in an audience in the dark like that, showing something that you've put so much like love and heart and blood and sweat and tears into?
It's awful.
it's a funny hybrid of emotions.
It is, yeah. I think it's you're really super hyper aware of everyone's reactions. And I think it's been a really funny experience, because when we first started making films, we started out in uni doing like silly comedy sketches and comedy shorts and just like trying our hand at all sorts of things. And it's really interesting when you sit in a crowd for a comedy, it's really like instant gratification, because that landed, everyone laughed. It's very easy to tell whether it's working or not working. Mm-hmm. Then when we started to go into the more the territory that we wanted to go in, which was, you know, dramas and thrillers and horrors, it's a really different experience because hopefully everyone's so engaged that they're just sitting quietly watching it. So it's really hard to tell whether people are bored, whether they're engaged, whether they're terrified. But it was really cool because we know we've heard some gasps and watched some people like shift uncomfortably and like, and you know, moments of like pure silence where everyone seems really engaged. So that's how we've kind of had to learn how to judge audience reactions. But it was certainly like quite unnerving the first few times that we did it.
We don't have a lot of, we don't have a lot of jump scares in the film, but a couple of times that there were jump scares, we got really good reaction from it. So that was, you know, a good kind of moment of stress relief. That they were at least engaged to that level in that first screening. So, but yeah, it was super exciting, but pretty scary that first screening.
Yeah.
Oh, I love that. That's so, I mean, I just think about what it would feel like when the kind of the credits roll and everybody's clapping and I'm, and I was so like happy for the filmmakers. So I'm glad that you kind of got to have that experience. So I understand that, it wasn't until maybe the last handful of years that you guys were really that into the horror genre, that it wasn't until you discovered films like Hereditary, The Witch, obviously the Australian classic, The Babadook. What was that journey like for you guys to, that made you decide to come from that to making a horror thriller?
Well, we kind of bonded over the fact that we both loved like thrillers. They were kind of like our gateway drug film into the horror world is what we always say, because you know, we're massive Fincher fans, are massive Fincher fans, and that's kind of what we bonded over at uni when we met, and that's what we were consuming, was a lot of, you know, suspenseful thriller films. And then, like you said, it wasn't until we kind of, I had a really warped idea of what horror was. Basically, I thought thrillers are thrillers and then horrors are kind of like, you know, stabby killer, you know, you know, like it's like, oh, and there's not much plot, there's not much drama, there's no like fun juicy acting to get into, but it was just because I hadn't really been watching them, I hadn't really been consuming them. And then it was like when we started to watch those films, like The Babadook, we went, oh my gosh, this is so cool. This is a really deep, well-written story with fantastic acting and an important message and some really great dialogue scenes, but all wrapped up in a really fun bundle that makes you super engaged in the story because you're utterly terrified or utterly, you know, in suspense. And it's so effective at what it does when it does it right. And that was kind of like, oh my gosh, wow, this is what horror is. This is what I've been missing out on. And then we just like delved into all sorts of films.
They were fully addicted.
And then it's now that we know this exists, this thing that we were missing out on, it's like you find yourself like looking for that in every film that you watch. And we found that when often the times now when we watch something and it doesn't have that element of darkness and that element of you know, terror or dread or suspense, you kind of feel a bit you know, yeah, it was good, but, you know, and then when you do get that box ticked for you when you're watching a film, it's so satisfying. So it's kind of like an addictive thing, I think, when you start to look for that all the time. It was kind of like a late coming experience of finding out what horror is and what it can be.
Which is also just so great just from the fact of we've had for the last couple of years and still have ahead of us so much awesome stuff to watch because, you know, we both grew up watching so many films. We've watched a lot of films. So it's like having this whole genre of I don't want to say content, but of creativity still to come. We've got a massive list still to go and we've got through so many. So it's just exciting to be reloaded with lots of new stuff to catch up on.
I love it. Do not tell your whore friends that you're ready for a list. They are going to go crazy. They're going to recommend so many things because already I'm like, have you seen?
Just adds another 10 to the list. It's huge, but it's great.
I love it. I mean, I think part of why I love horror is it's, and this was true as I watched this film, is it's the genre that you feel in your body. You know what I mean? Like you're very in your head when you're watching a drama, but when you're watching a good thriller or a good horror film, you can feel it like it's a visceral experience. And there are moments in this film that are just quiet dialogue moments where I could feel them in my body. So like, boom.
Awesome.
That's awesome. Yes. So, okay. So your film is pretty self-contained. It's essentially one location for the most part with two actors. I'm curious, you know, is it tricky when you're writing something like that to keep the momentum and the plot moving? Or is it in some ways make it easier because you have such a, like a singular focus?
Yeah, I think it weirdly, it's kind of a bit of both. I really liked the containedness from like when I'm starting to write something, I can get, if you don't have a central seed, like a central idea, and you're just like, oh, I want to sit down and write something, it's super overwhelming and borderline impossible because there's a million different options about what you can do. And, you know, it could be anything and everything. And then you're just not going to end up writing it because you just get too overwhelmed. So I liked the nature of it kind of being like a writing exercise in that it gave me constraints that I had to play in and gave me some direction of what I could do. So because we didn't really do it a traditional way of going, oh, I've got this brilliant idea for a film, let's make it. It was, we really want to make a feature film, yeah, but we know we're not going to have much money. So what can we make?
Right.
Kind of came at it that way. So those constraints of, okay, a single location and two actors, and then also even more so, we knew who we wanted to use in the film. We knew what two actors we wanted.
Okay.
That gave me lots of direction to start off with because you immediately have, you know, those dynamics at play that come with, okay, so we wanted Jordan Cowan to be in our film, a younger woman, Brendan Rock, an older man, in an enclosed environment together. Already there's a power dynamic at play. There's audience expectations that you can try and subvert, you know, and so it's kind of like that gave me lots of purpose and direction. The issues come when it comes to pacing, like you said, because people are so used to a visual cinematic language. They're used to how films typically work, and a film does not typically stay in a single location, and certainly most typically doesn't move in real time. Usually we span weeks, days, weeks, months, years in a single hour and a half film, not an hour and a half within an hour and a half film, if that makes sense. So that was really difficult because we were so aware that people are used to that language and would be expecting a certain rhythm and pace to the film, that if they aren't entertained and delivered that on time, then they'll just get bored, or you know, they'll stray and then they'll turn off and flick to another movie if they're watching on something. So
it was a constant conversation in the development. I think in the end you've kind of got to go, what do you like watching as an audience member? And then you've got to go, well, we like when they're pulled off, we like that kind of film, we like a bit of a slower burn. So in the end, you've just kind of got to go, we'll do our best to satisfy, you know, us, pretending that we're the viewer.
Yeah.
And you just got to go, there will be a portion of the audience who really like that kind of slower burn. And you just kind of got to commit. But having said that, we can say, oh, we'll commit. We can say that at every step. But at every step, there was definitely moments of doubt and adjustment. It's like script stage, you know, we at the start we were like, yep, we're committing to this, but then you do have moments when you're designing it, when you're storyboarding, when you're like, oh, this is a lot of this kind of thing or this kind of thing, and sometimes we would make adjustments to the script based on that. Once we had shot the film, that was a really interesting process in post-production, because you just couldn't really pace it up. We're very used to, even though we hadn't done a feature before, even in shorts, you suddenly cut out a whole chunk of a scene, or, you know, they now arrive at this location. It's now the next day. But you just couldn't do that. And interestingly, when we tried, we did a lot of experimenting when we tried to move stuff out. If you suddenly jumped time, it kind of ruined the, you know, again, we had committed to this real time feeling, and it kind of unraveled everything. So you just had to commit. So it was a lot of very little adjustments the whole time to kind of get to where we landed. It was a pretty fascinating process. But hopefully where we've landed, if you're into that kind of film, hopefully it works for you. And again, that's the best thing about things like it playing at a Tribeca and now it going out to an audience, is that we're able to get some responses and gauge, because we're kind of guessing the pace in a room and testing it on, you know, like 10 or so people. So it's been great to get responses from people who dig that kind of thing, really engage with it.
I mean, I think it needs the space to breathe. That's where the atmosphere lives. That's where the dread and the tension lives, is in those in that real time feeling. And I think if you had tried to pace it up more, you risk losing the logic of this cat and mouse back and forth between the two characters. So, I mean, it worked for me.
Right, it's right. As soon as we doubted it and stopped committing to this is the film that we're making, it just unraveled and then didn't satisfy that either. So then it was kind of satisfying neither party. So it was a really interesting learning process. It's good fun.
Well, I mean, I think you also, I mean, it sounds like you had them in, I wanted to talk about the casting because so much of this movie hangs on both of these characters being able to convincingly go back and forth from being, you know, seeming very vulnerable, seeming very sinister, really kind of keeping you on your toes of like, who is the cat, who is the mouse in this situation. And I was going to ask kind of what the moment of casting, like when you knew they were the right person, but it sounds like you actually kind of reverse engineered it. So tell me about how those dynamics played into, you know, when you were like, okay, these are the characters that I want to write for these actors.
Yeah, well, like you said, it was a bit of a reverse engineering exercise because, you know, there's so much pressure on casting, and casting is most of the film. You know, if you don't get it right, then the film's just never, no matter what you do, it's just never really going to work. So we wanted to take that pressure off of the film by using these two great actors who we'd already worked with previously on a short film. In fact, Brendan, we'd worked with twice before already. On our short film, The Recordist, that we did together, we worked with both Brendan and Jordan, and we all got along really well. They got along together really well, and we just kind of developed a bit of a shorthand. It was really easy to work with them. They both had lots of theatre experience, so they were really into the style of films that we make where we have long monologue dialogue scenes, and they really enjoyed that process of rehearsing and all that kind of stuff. So we just knew if we were going to pull this off, we needed two great actors to do it. Let's just get these two guys who we've already worked with, who we already know, and who we know will do a brilliant job with whatever the story ends up being, and then write something for them and for their strengths. So even when we were writing, we messaged Brendan and asked him to grow a beard for the film. I don't think he'd even read it at that point.
He was just game.
So we said to them, we really want to do a feature. Hey, are you in? And they both went, yep, sure, whatever you want to do. So then we just thought, let's reverse engineer something for these two guys. And it just literally took all the pressure off of the casting process. And it also, as I said before, helped a lot with the direction of the script, because we already knew exactly who we were going to have on screen. We had, Joe was storyboarding, like, you know, little figurines of Brendan and Jordan. Like, we already knew exactly who they were going to be. We could, like, write the costuming into the script. You know, what her hair would look like, what this and that. I even wrote, I'd seen that Jordan had a real tattoo on our previous short film, and I wrote that this script because I really liked her tattoo and I thought it was cool. So it's like, it was really custom made for these two actors. So if one of them had pulled out, we would have been in a lot of trouble.
we got really lucky in that for a previous short film, we went over to the Austin Film Festival, and while we were there, we listened to a talk with a filmmaker called Trey Edward Schultz, who did It Comes at Night, which we really love, and it's for his new film there. And he was talking about his first, he did kind of a low-budget, micro-budget film called Krisha, which we love and was really good. And it's just really interesting to hear him talk about how that jump-started his career. And we were kind of came back to Australia and we were kind of throwing around different ideas of, if we did that kind of thing, what would that be? What kind of avenues could we take? And we literally landed and started filming our next short film, which was called The Recordist, which had Brendan and Jordan. So we were kind of in the background of making that short film. We were constantly having this conversation, and in post, we were just kind of watching these two in scenes together, some long dialogue scenes together, and we were going, these guys just, we feel like these guys are really interesting together. And then we were showing people the short film, and they were really responding to them on screen. So we kind of, you know, it was just kind of the perfect timing, because we really wanted to go next into doing that feature film, and we were loving working with them. So we kind of just went, let's see if we can expand on this. So while we were at the end of post-production on that short film, we approached Brendan and Jordan and said, do you want to do something crazy together? And, they jumped in. So, we were so lucky, and it was just kind of the perfect timing.
Yeah.
Yeah, they have incredible chemistry together. That card game scene, the roller coaster, and then the way it sweeps your legs out from under you is just so, it's perfect. It's perfection.
Aww, thank you.
Yeah, they did so well.
Yeah. So, okay, I don't want to get into spoilers, but I am curious watching the film and sort of the, as we get later in the film and we find out more of what's going on, were there any like real crime cases or anything like that that inspired any of the aspects of that part of the sort of in-world mythology?
I don't think that there was a particular case. I think it was more just, I'm one of those stereotypical people who loves true crime podcasts. That's my bread and butter. That's what I do every day when I'm making my breakfast or when I'm at the gym, I'm listening to people.
Relaxing. Yes.
So that's what I'm kind of fascinated by all of that and how people's minds work in that way. But just because it seems like such a foreign concept that people can function in that way in everyday life, but it's real when it happens, and I just find it really interesting, kind of like thinking about how these people who can be, without spoilers, but these people can be terrible people, but they're also people. So where do you sympathize? Where do you draw the line? What's genuine about them? How much of it can you place on their childhood or their upbringing, and like how do you weigh that against what they've done? I don't know, I just find it interesting, and that it's like, you know, we can live in a society where these people, you know, go to the supermarket with us and we just have no idea. And then kind of mixing that idea with, we've always said Australia is such an interesting country because we have this huge amount of land and are a really small population, and you just drive anywhere in Australia and there are these little pockets of towns with tiny populations, and the people are so isolated and so fascinating, and you just know that there would be some really strange, interesting characters out there who have these whole hidden lives that we have absolutely no idea about. So it was kind of like a merging of those two things, but nothing, no one particular story, but just more finding that whole area interesting to look at.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, so as a woman, I definitely identified sort of with the initial sort of core fear that this is mining, which is that uncertainty where she is now put herself in a position where she needs help. But also it feels a little bit of out of the fire into the, what is it? Out of the frying pan into the fire situation.
Yeah.
I'm curious, in that element of the film, is that something that you drew on personal experiences of feeling that kind of vulnerability? Josiah, just kidding, Indiana, but also I'd love to hear both of your answers on that.
This is actually a really funny thing to bring up because we talked about this a lot. I am such a people pleaser that I would probably die rather than offend someone, like by, you know, asking to leave or like saying, hey, I feel uncomfortable, don't do that. Like I would probably die. And there was even a particular story, which, you know, ring up when I was overseas with my sister, and we were in a marketplace, and someone asked us to come and look at their jewelry shop, and we just went along with it, and we followed this particular man down an alley, and we were both going, this is we feel a little bit freaked out, but we both still followed him, even though there was like massive red flags. We were both actually really frightened, but yet we still followed this man down this alley and into a shop. Anyway, it all ended up being fine. It was dodgy, but someone helped us. It all ended up being fine, but in hindsight.
Pretty young, right?
And we were quite young, but it's like, oh my gosh, okay, now in a real life situation, I've tested the theory and I probably would just die rather than offend someone. So I kind of talked about that quite a bit of like, you know, it, in the actual reality of the situation of like, if I was in her shoes, you know, how it is at the beginning of this film, I probably would stay and I probably would just make polite conversation, even if I felt really uncomfortable or threatened, because that's just the way that I'm wired. And I think it's actually a way that lots of women are wired, because it's kind of like you're you know, how society wants us to be a certain way of being polite and accommodating. And you kind of feel like you, sometimes you would rather sacrifice your own safety than actually speak up and say, oh, hey, I find this a bit uncomfortable. So that is actually something we wanted to play with a bit at the start of the film, of like having these opportunities where you could really put your foot down and go, actually, no, this isn't right. But like in reality, would you do that? It always feels like there needs to be kind of like another force keeping her there. So yeah, that's something we talked about a fair bit.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's also complicated in that, and maybe you can speak to this too as well, Indiana, is that like also niceness is to some degree a survival tactic, because you have to like gently back away. So the moment where she does finally like stand her boundaries, that's the moment where I'm like, oh, you're in the most danger.
Yes.
I don't know. Was that something that a dynamic that was playing into it? And I'm curious, when you guys were having discussions in the writing, were there moments, Josiah, where you were like, I don't know, does this feel real? And then Indiana was like, no, really, this is how it is.
I mean, no, honestly, I didn't doubt it. In the writing process, there were times where things were more extreme or not as much. So that was, of course, constantly a conversation. But in our, for instance, the conversation continued throughout post, because you use a certain take or you know, we were really kind of fluctuating how Jordan was responding in any situation. So it was a constant situation. It was a constant conversation. Apologies. But yeah, I don't know. I'm kind of the same as well. I'm a bit overly polite. And although I am way more of a scaredy cat than Indiana, and have bailed out of situations that probably seem weird that I bailed, and they probably were nothing. it is that whole thing of we were trying to make sure that every time this character felt uncomfortable, there was something straight after to, at least at a surface level, offset how she was feeling before. So you never really, I for me bought it, because I feel like we've been in very tame versions of the situation where I've been there, and it is like you can feel the awkwardness and the uncomfortability increase, but you're like, but it's probably nothing.
Yeah,
that's the big thing. It's that it's probably nothing.
Yeah,
It's just so unbelievably uncomfortable to think, oh, I'm going to seem anxious and leave. And then that person standing there like, what the heck? That's insane that we think that way. But I think as humans, that is how we feel.
And also we were kind of careful with not only like what takes we used of Jordan's and how she was reacting to things, but also how we presented Brendan in that. Patrick, but we didn't want him, we were kind of careful that there was nothing that she could really pin on him and go like, oh, see, look, you just did that. That's really wrong. I'm going to go. It's more like just a feeling and an atmosphere in the air, that is making her uncomfortable, not so much any direct actions by this man, which I think also, again, is a thing that it's like when we're in these situations, sometimes you can just pick up on a vibe makes you feel uncomfortable, rather than something that's like an actual direct comment or a look or whatever that you can pin on someone to say, you know what, actually that's enough, I'm gonna go. So it kind of also makes you feel like you're potentially a little bit crazy and you're a little bit overreactive, and you know, makes you doubt yourself. So that's something that we kind of wanted to push and pull between the two of them, sometimes where the audience goes, she's actually acting a bit weird, and sometimes where the audience looks at him and goes, wow, he's acting a bit weird. So we can kind of like fluctuate between the two.
And this was all the great benefit of having worked with Brendan and Jordan before, was because at every step we were obviously having this conversation. But, you know, most of the time we had, this is where we're aiming for. But sometimes we just said, this exact moment, we're not going to know precisely what it is until we're in the edit, until we're testing on people. So they would be patient and game to go through slight variations for like 5 different takes. And then we would just kind of adjust, test on people. And, you know, some actors I don't think would be game to go, you know, they'd go, I want it to be exactly this, or I need to know exactly what you want it to be, but they were very open and trusting with letting us get some options.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I loved that element of it so much, because I actually felt like there were a lot of red flags on both sides, as you said, but then you would follow it up with a moment where you gave her a permission structure to be like, because she wanted to be safe. She wanted to not be afraid. And he would do something or say something that would like give her that opportunity to be like, oh no, this is okay. And I felt that was very realistic. And we all want to imagine that we would be like the brave one to be like, no, this is my boundary. But I think this is actually a much more realistic way that something like this would play out. So we've talked about atmosphere. We've talked about the incredible performances. The other sort of star of this for me was definitely the sound design, all of the creaking boards, all of those kinds of things. Can you talk a little bit about with the storm raging outside, sort of your decisions around how you approach the sound design of the film?
Yeah.
Yeah, we always knew that sound was going to play a huge part in this film, like for a few reasons. One, just because we're obsessed with sound and film, we know that kind of is 90% of storytelling is through the sound in filmmaking. But also because when we're working at this lower budget range, we knew that sound was kind of the tool that we had at our fingertips to help tell the story, but also make it feel grander, larger, than it actually is in real life. So we knew that, like, on a practical level, we needed sound to sell the storm, because throughout the film you're not seeing it all the time. You're kind of reminded of it when someone looks out a window or you cut to a wide, but largely we're just contained inside with these two characters. So we needed it to feel like there was a constant a constant storm raging outside that's kind of keeping these two together, and that there's it's really isolating them, and so you feel that claustrophobia. So that was like the practical side of needing really intense amounts of sound. But then the other side of it became more and more present when we were in post-production with our amazing sound designer, Duncan Campbell. And we basically just started to add layers and layers, and it started to add so much more to the atmosphere that it kind of just snowballed in post-production, where we went, oh, actually this needs more of this and this needs more of this. And we kept on adding and adding and layering. We got the actors to record some more stuff in a studio, and then we were like, Duncan was like, melding that into the sound design. So it started to become really obvious that the sound was the star of the film and kind of like the main driver of the storytelling, and that we could weave so much more storytelling into the sound in post-production that really just suited, by the time you get to the end of the film, what this film is.
We were kind of making two versions of the film. We were making hopefully the experience for the first watch through, where you needed to go storm, she can't leave. And then we really added a lot of layers of the more psychological elements for if you were to watch it again, hopefully here are the clues to what the film is actually about. And they're largely in the film, in the sound. So Duncan Campbell, we can't speak highly enough about
him. He's awesome.
Yeah. I mean, sound and score, they are unsung often. And I think about just like when you go back to classic horror, it was those sounds like in The Haunting, things like that, that really elevated it. And I could feel those like influences in this. And I really, really love the sound design. I have a million more questions, but I know we're at the end of our time. So I have one last one, because it is Women in Horror Month. In this podcast, we focus on really trying to elevate the voices of women in horror and their allies, of course, Josiah. So I'm curious for you, Indiana, do you have any advice for young women who want to direct, but maybe feel like that's not an option for them, or they wouldn't be welcome in the space, anything like that?
Yeah, well, it's an interesting thing, because I think I have grown up in a very privileged time in terms of entering the film industry as a woman. I feel like there's never been a point where, I've just been really lucky, and there's never been a point where I've ever felt like, I don't belong somewhere.
I love that.
Yeah, I think it's just one of those things of this current movement in the film industry, and there's lots of really cool you know, female filmmakers that are kind of being like highlighted right now. And so, and lots of initiatives in film festivals as well. So like you feel quite welcome when you're entering film festivals because they'll be like celebrating, you know, women in horror or this, that, and the other. So I feel like my advice would be to just try it, and like I think you'd be surprised by how you know, welcome and embrace that you feel. I've you know, felt like I've had a great experience.
I'm so glad. I mean, when we started this show, I mean, I even in just the handful of years we've been doing the show, I feel like the industry has really shifted, and it's exciting to hear that that is not just a perception as someone who's very much on the outside, a professional appreciator, but like actually on the inside as well. That's really inspiring.
Yeah, it's been good.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, both of you, for taking the time to chat with me today and being so generous with your time. It has been amazing. I love the film. I cannot wait for people to see it. I feel like it is absolutely going to find a huge audience. Like there is a classic Hitchcockian thriller aspect that I feel like I have not seen a lot of in recent years. And so it was a really exciting and you know, engrossing watch for me. And I think people are really going to love it.
Thank you so much. Thanks for chatting
to us.
Very
kind words. And yeah, it was lovely to chat with you.
All right. So that was my conversation with Indiana Bell and Josiah Allen. See, I mean, here's the thing. It's like, you don't need, like, I'm teasing a little bit, but you've definitely, there have been situations where you definitely had to roll solo. So I was happy to do it this time. Although yeah, I would have loved to have you there because it was such a great conversation.
I know, it sounded like it. And, you know, I helped out some with the questions. And when I was researching them a little bit to do that, I was like, I really wanted to talk to them. So I was disappointed that that didn't happen. But I'm so glad that you got to talk to them. And the people
Me
are going to get to hear it. Yeah,
I think, I hope everybody enjoyed the interview as much as I enjoyed doing it. Mm-hmm. I loved, there were so many things, like hearing them talking about the casting and how they like built these characters specifically around these actors, I think was really interesting because, like I said, it lives or dies on the chemistry between these two. And they took, you know, somewhat of a risk to be like, okay, you guys were great in the short. How would you do in a full like premiere feature? And I really feel like their instincts were right and they pulled it off. So that was cool. Listening to them talk about like that whole thing about being polite in situations where you are in danger. Like she was talking about how she basically was like, yeah, this is how I die. She's like, I will die before I will be, you know, impolite. So that was, I don't know. And then I like kind of, one of the moments that really touched me was I kind of started to joke with Josiah about like, you know, like, did she have to explain this is a real thing? Or, and he was like, oh, no. I totally get it. I'm the, like, I get hella scared in these situations and would worry about being polite. Like, he actually really empathized with that. And it,
oh, that's great.
Yeah, that was cool. And then lastly, when we talked about her experiences in the industry, I think that we've almost come to expect when we ask that question that the answer be, yes, I have had those like negative experiences that are very gendered. So to hear her say like, that's really just not been my experience is kind of amazing. I understand that's not everyone's experience, but it's also not like everyone's experience. You know what I mean? Which that anyone is getting through this in the way that she is says something is changing, because there was a time where no one would have.
Right. Yeah. No, I think that's encouraging. And hopefully we'll just start hearing that more and more from filmmakers we talk to as the years go on.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I'm excited. It sounds to me like they're not going anywhere. They have found a genre that they love. Mm-hmm. And if this is the kind of movies they want to make, then I'm happy to have them here. And I cannot wait to see what they do next.
Yeah, I think this is a kind of perfect movie for Shudder. Like it feels very in keeping with what they do. So I hope it finds like a big audience.
Me too. I think it's going to be a little bit of one of those things where like word of mouth does it some favors, you know? All right. Well, that is it for our episode. If you have some thoughts, if you liked the interview you had, is there someone you'd like us to speak to? I don't know. Whatever you want to say. You can always email us at rachel@zombiegirls.com. You can come chat with us over on the Zombie Girls Facebook page. If you're enjoying the show, do us a solid and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever it is you're getting your pods. And if you're looking for something spooky tonight because you've already watched this, then you should check out our video on demand and streaming calendar at zombiegirls.com, where we keep track of all the spooky doings that are happening on all the streaming services. And then finally, because you love us and you want to support us with some key-ish money, you can do that by buying some of our sweet, sweet merch at zombiegirls.com/merch, or even better, joining our Patreon at patreon.com/zombiegirls, where you get bonus episodes, extended episodes, and you get to hang out with us on the Discord, which is the dopest. All right, that is it, except for our plan for the next episode. Ariel, what are we doing next?
Yeah, so our next episode is a special one for the end of Women in Horror Month. You are going to be listening to Rachel, Matilda, and I talk about Lisa Frankenstein, where we're going to be comparing it to Weird Science, which was one of its inspirations. It's a really fun episode. I can't wait for you guys to hear it.
All right. On that note, we're done, girl. Take us out.
All right. Thank you so much for listening to another episode of More Deadly Director's Cut. We hope you enjoyed our interview with these filmmakers. It was really special. I'm sad that I missed it, but it was such a good one. Congratulations, Rachel, on another great interview. And that's going to do it for us. Bye, everybody.
Bye, everybody. Thanks to everyone for listening, and thanks to my co-host Ariel, who is always willing to come on here and geek out about horror with me. And finally, thanks to the women who make the horror films we love so much. Production on this episode was done by yours truly, editing was done by Ariel Messman-Rucker, and our theme music is More Deadly by Elizabeth Kyle and Eric Newell.